between George Siemens and myself. And George had recently run a Connectivism conference online, and that was quite a success. And we were talking about the objections and the challenges to Connectivism. This was at, I think it was at the conference that we both attended with Desire to Learn in Memphis. And I think that would be in 2007 or something like that. And so we decided to put on a course that would illustrate the theory that we were describing. So we figured, okay, we'll put on a Connectivism course. And that would be in the fall of 2008. We decided to put that on. And it became the first MOOC, kind of by accident. Because we just set up the course, and then we ended up with 2,400 people in it.
Okay, so what was it that... what was it that was inspiring about sort of teaching and sort of the massive amount of students? What was it that sparked your interest?
Well, they sort of showed up and we were already committed. So, I mean, we didn't go out seeking to teach a massive number of students. We went out seeking to demonstrate a certain type of online course, which, as it turns out, can support a massive number of students. And it was the first online course that could do that.
Okay, yeah. So you started teaching this course, and as you started teaching MOOCs, what was sort of your initial excitement when teaching these MOOCs?
I'm not sure what you're asking when you're asking what is your initial excitement. I'm not sure what you mean.
But basically, was there something that surprised you or made you sort of surprised you that you wouldn't have thought of that made it a good experience?
Well, I mean, the sheer number of people that signed up was the big first surprise. But the rest of it we pretty much expected because it was what was predicted by the theory. We found, for example, a high degree of engagement and a high degree of communication among the participants and a great deal of creativity. And these were all really nice and interesting to observe, but they weren't surprises. We expected that.
Okay. Yeah. Looking at your sort of entire experience teaching a MOOC, was there some point during these MOOCs where you reached a certain high point, a certain point during the course where it's especially functional?
I think the most interesting development occurred during CCK 09, which was the second MOOC. And we were teaching the Connectivism MOOC for the second time. And a large number of the students from the first year came back the second year. And that surprised us, certainly surprised me. And then it's almost like they began teaching the course themselves. They were guiding discussion, answering questions and all of that. And that was quite surprising to me. That's something I had not expected, but in retrospect, I probably should have.
Okay, why?
Because the reason why is the Connectivist approach to learning is very self-directed, and people choose their own roles and their own degree of involvement. And so we should have expected that one of the roles that people would choose would be the role of helping other people.
Yeah. Okay. That's interesting. That's very interesting. What as a teacher, what opportunities that do you get from teaching a MOOC? What does it provide for you as a teacher?
I think that it provides me with a very up-to-date insight into the subject material. Like, teaching a MOOC isn't like teaching an ordinary subject where I'm the person who knows everything and I'm sharing my knowledge with the students. Rather, it's more like a distributed conversation where everybody finds and brings in their own unique contributions. And so every time I've taught a MOOC, I've been exposed to interesting and valuable resources that participants have either created or found on the internet that shed new light on the subject. And sometimes these are in the form of criticism of existing ideas. Sometimes they're embellishments or illustrations of the ideas. Sometimes they're applications of the ideas in novel situations. And sometimes they're things from other disciplines where we didn't know that there was a connection, but it turns out that there is.
Okay. What if you, when teaching a MOOC, what was something that challenged you in teaching a MOOC?
The biggest challenge for me was the expectation on the part of participants that the course would be a traditional teacher-based, content-based course. With the subtext that some people, certainly the more experienced educators, thought that a connectivist course was necessarily a constructivist course and expected, you know, more constructivist features than we provided.
And that would be, for example?
For example, scaffolding of knowledge construction on the part of participants. It would be, for example, playing the role of facilitator and supporter rather than the role of an expert in the domain that we are discussing.
Okay.
And those may be features of constructivism, but they're not features of connectivism.
How did the connectivism differ?
The instructors, and for example myself, participated actively in the course almost as though they were super enabled students. So we were active participants in the discussion, bringing our own ideas and thoughts into the mix. And so, we didn't take this, we stand apart and have the students do all of the knowledge constructing. We're active participants in that. That's how I'll phrase it for now.
If you were to put some highlights to the most important factors that help MOOCs to create a good learning experience.
First of all, individual self-management by the participants. People could choose their own mode of participation. They chose for themselves what they wanted to get out of the course, what their learning objectives were, if any, and how they would participate in the course. I think that was a significant factor. So the people in the course were motivated. They were interested and motivated and felt able to express themselves. The second major thing was the distributed network that we built to support the course, which meant that participants could use their own existing writing and communications applications, such as Blogger or Facebook or Twitter or whatever, And this meant that people were familiar and comfortable with the technology used in the course pretty much right from the beginning.
Okay, yeah. So these are some of the two most important factors of making a good experience.
Yeah, if I had to add one more, it would be the daily newsletter, which really provided a thread of continuity for people. And the newsletter was reported by students in surveys as the most significant aspect of the course.
Okay, so...
So you got three. Three for the price of two.
Okay. Let me see here. Okay, this is a question about what MOOCs and sort of what are the value of MOOCs? What value does it possess, as you see?
Well, I mean, MOOCs have different value to every individual and every organization. There is no single expression of what the value of a MOOC is. I mean, for me, a MOOC is valuable as continual professional development. Participation in a MOOC puts me right at the cutting edge of my discipline. For other people, a MOOC provides access to other people in their community of practice. You know, it gives them access to experts, it gives them access to other students. For other people, a MOOC is a way of getting good experience when they're just starting out of what it's really like to work in some discipline or another. For an institution, a MOOC might serve as a form of advertisement. It might help better prepare students for courses they're going to take in the future. For a company, a MOOC might be a way of advertising their technology or testing their technology or putting their technology to work. Some publishers have used MOOCs in order to promote online sales of books and comics. I don't necessarily support that, but that's what they find it valuable for. And so on. And there's a wide range of ways people find them valuable.
Okay, good point. Okay, is there something about yourself that's a contributor to MOOCs that the format of a MOOC that allows you to, is there something that the MOOC as a way of teaching that it allows you to do that you feel is better than traditional learning experiences?
Let me think about that. The problem is when I taught in traditional environments, to a large degree, I taught in the same way anyways. I mean, I draw a lot from my actual in-class teaching experience, but I wasn't a typical in-class teacher.
But what is it that you can use from your in-class experience and use on MOOCs? One of the elements
One of the strategies that I used, and I was able to use this in a wide variety of courses, is a strategy along the lines of, you already know what I'm about to teach you. I'm not teaching you stuff you don't know. What I'm showing you is how to talk about it, how to express it, how to use it, and to make you aware that you already know this and you already use this. You know, and I applied that in everything from ethics to philosophy of science to logic and critical reasoning. And the method here was really just to show, to demonstrate and model the sort of practice that I wanted the students to be able to achieve. And more importantly, that they wanted to be able to achieve. I think the big difference is that in the MOOC, they were no longer required to attend my class, so they were there because they wanted to be. And the other thing, too, is in the traditional experience, I had to do a whole pile of marking of assignments, and in the MOOC, not so much.
Yeah, okay.
Which is good, because I hated marking.
But do you think that, that means that students aren't getting your marks? Does that have an influence, you think, on the learning you're able to get out of the MOOC?
Well, I mean, what they don't get from me is a grade, right? But they still get all my comments and feedback and reactions, and especially, I feel less constrained in my response to students because I'm not in this position of power over them. So I can be more honest and more direct in my assessment. And they don't or shouldn't feel threatened by that. This whole power relationship thing, again, it's one of these things that's hard to shake students of, right? Because they perceive that the instructor is the power in the course and has legislative force. And I've tried as much as possible in defining and organizing MOOCs to remove the impact of that power imbalance. It's impossible completely because I designed the environment as well. So, anytime somebody creates software and other people use it, the person who created the software has a certain degree of power, which they may exercise well or maliciously. I've always tried to exercise it well and to design software that creates as open an environment as possible in order specifically to minimize the impact of power on the learning relation.
Okay, that's great. Let's try and move on. Let's see. Question. Yeah. All right. So these are some of the capabilities that we discussed that MOOCs have. What are MOOCs able to change in the way we can deliver higher education? What kind of bold steps could we take to make some improvements to the higher education system with MOOCs?
Well, everybody's focused on the massiveness, but to me, the significant aspect of the MOOC is that it supports open learning. And to me, one of the biggest weaknesses of the educational system worldwide today is that access to it is limited by people in the right cultural environment with sufficient means. And MOOCs have the potential to remove the effect of these barriers, or at least limit the effect of these barriers, to enable people who would not previously have had access to, especially, a higher education environment, but education environments in general, to have access to them, and to remove a little bit of the barrier that exists between the people who were in the education group and people who were not. Once everybody can see an online course and go into it and look at it and go through it and follow the discussion that takes place or the work that's being done, a large part of the mystery that accompanies higher education, especially, but education in general, is removed. And by removing the mystery, that in itself makes it more accessible and more approachable by people. And finally, it limits the risk that people undertake in order to become educated. Right now... Sorry? Well, there's the risk of time, there's the financial risk, because It involves a large investment of money. There's even just the risk of displacing yourself, removing yourself from whatever environment you're in, into this new environment where you're not familiar with it, you don't know what's going to happen, and you know you're going to be judged and evaluated, and that might not go well. So it removes all of these risks. And makes education just something you can enter into the way you enter into a website or start reading a book.
That's good. That's a good point. So people I've been talking with, or teachers, they focus a lot about getting rid of the redundancy in the educational system.
Yeah.
That's something that you see as a capability that MOOCs have.
Yes and no. The redundancies that people talk about are, for example, many instances of a single class being taught being replaced by a single instance of that class. And that's not really the sort of redundancy that MOOCs, in my mind, address, because it presupposes that there is a single version of a class that is appropriate for all people. And we'll just mass produce that class and put masses of people into it and eliminate redundancies, which is a narrow and uncomprehending way of understanding the potential of MOOCs. What MOOCs do is they allow us to focus our, I don't want to use business jargon, but focus our investment precisely where it is needed. I'll give you an example. Take a group of people. Five of them might need extra instruction and resources in trigonometry. So a MOOC allows them to pursue that in their own way at their own time without imposing it on the other 95 people who are just fine in the subject or who have no interest in the subject. Works out the same either way. So there's that kind of rationalization that is a rationalization through personalization rather than a rationalization by quote-unquote elimination of redundancies.
So the customization of a learning experience. So this is also a matter of adding choices to people's education or career and stuff like that. But do you feel that there are some, I see MOOCs as something where people can start to build their education from these modules of courses. But what is it that, if you were to think of something that worked great in the old education system, that you had degrees that are, sort of a graduate degree or a bachelor degree, where you have certain courses that end up giving you a profile. Is that not something that you might lose with focusing much on the component side of MOOCs?
What do you mean, certain courses that give you profile?
I have a bachelor level degree and I'm finishing my master, and I know I have introduction to communication 1 and 2. I had these fundamental courses, and these were sort of predetermined courses that I had to take in order to get this degree.
Right.
But I sort of, I want to hope at least that there was some thought behind why I needed those same courses in combination to get me a degree or that sort of makes sense in the big picture.
One would hope there was some thought behind them.
Exactly.
Sometimes it's a vain hope. But even if there was thought behind them, it's not clear that the thought that resulted in them becoming mandatory a number of years ago applies to this day. And it's not clear. I mean, Seymour Papert expressed it once. He said that the demonstration that a particular subject or course is fundamental is the fact that this course is needed to do whatever it is that you want to do. So what makes Communications 101 fundamental isn't the fact that you had to take Communications 101. In fact, that's a pretty bad proxy for it, isn't it? What makes that content fundamental is that you can't do good communications without having mastered those skills or that content set. And I use those phrases very, very loosely. And it's fundamental only in the sense that the sort of thing you want to do is the sort of thing that involves those fundamental skills. So now the degree stands as a shorthand for you having all of these fundamentals. But what it doesn't tell me is whether what you were doing had anything to do with those fundamentals at all. Whether your purpose in taking a communications degree had anything to do with the skills that were taught in Communications 101. And that's pretty relevant because it's going to tell me whether or not you put any effort into the course. Mm-hmm. You know, and people's grades don't necessarily reflect the effort or the interest in the course. You know, I mean, I look at my own academic career. I could get A's in courses I put almost no effort into just because the course wasn't that difficult. And I struggled in other courses, and, you know, for no good reason, even though I was really interested in them.
But you see MOOCs as something that overcomes that problem. I
see certification that doesn't depend on credentialing anymore as something that overcomes that problem. And in particular, assessment of individual achievement and competence directly rather than by means of a proxy such as a degree or a test or some sort of certification.
Okay, so that means that that MOOCs are also, at least in your view, something that should end up in some kind of post product or
Some sort of product? No.
Not a product, but I mean, the evaluation of what I got out of the MOOC shouldn't be a certificate of what I did in my final exam, but should more be what I actually used, if I could apply the theory to create something of value.
Yeah. Or even just in your interactions with other people. Mm. You know, suppose you were interested in archaeology and took some open online courses in archaeology, and then we come along later and you're talking and I'm talking and we're talking about archaeology and digs and things like that, and you start using some of the terminology. If you use it correctly, and I'm an archaeologist, I'll note to myself, oh, he uses that terminology correctly. You know, if in our conversation you're able to reference theories and positions or events that were important in archaeology, I will be able to assess your competence just by recognizing, oh, yeah, he's an archaeologist. He knows this. He does this. You know, even like, you know, if we go to a dig and you start, you know, doing stuff with the soil, whatever archaeologists do, I'll look at what you do with the soil and I'll be able to tell, oh, yeah, he's done that before. He knows what he's doing. On the other hand, you know, if you use the words incorrectly, if you make assertions that demonstrate that you're not familiar with a whole theoretical framework, if you're clumsy with the tools and break artifacts, I can tell you're not really a qualified archaeologist. And this has nothing to do with the degree or the credential, right? It's direct observation and recognition. And that's what will replace, that will replace credentialing now, because direct observation or recognition will become possible on a massive scale. But all of that's independent of MOOCs.
Okay. Right. But is it independent of MOOCs, or is it, I mean, I see MOOCs as something that is making that possible by having a more detailed degree of measuring when, what did he write in the forms, how did he answer the questions, and stuff like that, that you, instead of just going to a final exam in the current system where you have 4 hours, and that's it. Now you have a 4 week or 8 week course where you can measure exactly on all parameters from small quizzes to interactions in the forums and so on.
Yeah, but the evaluation doesn't happen in the course. The evaluation happens outside the course. It's not part of the course. And
okay.
It could happen during the course. It could happen 10 years after the course.
Mm.
And that's actually when it's appropriate.
But how would you evaluate 10 years after, could you try to explain?
Because MOOCs form a part of an open online community and infrastructure where the work that we do not privately, but in such a way that this work, these interactions, these communications can be assessed independently by third parties.
Okay. All right. I get it. So in order for this sort of a vision of a new educational system, what are some of the components that need to get developed? Are there something that are missing in this sort of design, if you want to call it that?
The main thing is open technology. Most of the learning technology that has been developed to date has been developed for closed environments and institutional applications where access to content is limited through authentication and password and often payment of money, where learning itself is restricted only to people who can pay tuition. And then where work and community activities thereafter are in some way or another similarly closed. We can only make this work, the teaching part and the assessment part, we can only make this work if we think of online interaction as something that is open by default. Doesn't mean everything is open, but it means the default is open. That unless you take measures to close it, what you say in a public online forum is public.
So in this sort of new idea of an educational system, what changes in terms of the educator's role? You touched upon it in the beginning, that you get more of an active participant, and the learner's role as well. But if we touch upon maybe the university's role.
I wrote a paper a while back called The Role of the Educator, and identified something like 25 different roles that are currently filled by educators. Yeah. And this is what I think happens. I think that, you know, the bundled manual hands-on task that we today associate with the educator is something that will be unbundled and managed in a different way for each of the different applications. So there will be some people who focus on presenting and talking about you know, doing the online videos, the TED Talk, the Richard Feynman interviews, stuff like that. There will be other people who focus on assessment. There will be other people who focus on creating environments where this sort of discourse can happen. They will be social agents of some sort, or as Nancy White says, social artists. Well, just a person who's able to make a community of whatever it is, community of archaeologists, functional.
Okay.
Archaeologists don't naturally inhabit the same space, and they don't naturally talk to each other. Their interactions need to be facilitated by somebody who's comfortable with both facilitation and archaeology. So it's a bit of a skill, right?
And sort of what would this mean for the universities? I mean, what are their role in this new paradigm?
Well, universities have three major roles today. And these major roles are, first of all, teaching people. Secondly, evaluating their learning. And third, conducting original research and development in different academic fields. They're going to be challenged to maintain these roles, to say the least. Different institutions will probably focus on in different directions. So I would expect some to really focus on the teaching, others to really focus on the evaluation. For example, the elite universities like MIT and Harvard and Stanford are kind of following a model that was pioneered by, say, the TED Talks, where they're really focused on presenting their courses as events that people can watch and follow for free. But if you want to be one of the you know, the high and mighty in the crowd, you have to pay the tuition and get into the class. And that's a role. You know, it's kind of like education TV, where the students are the new stars. It's almost like, you know, MIT class has reality TV. So that's one role. University of Phoenix, say, for example, I'm just picking it out of the air. I'm not talking about any knowledge that I have. They might focus on evaluation, prior learning assessment, recognition and granting of credentials. That might be what they do. Other universities might almost abandon the student function completely and turn into research and technology organizations.
Okay.
Become part of IBM.
How, what did separating these functions of the university, wouldn't that have some negatives in terms of actually having the food chain from research to education and learning?
Well, yes and no, right? Because, I mean, the argument has always been, in order to be a good teacher of some subject, you have to be immersed in the research of the subject. And in order to be a good researcher of the subject, you have to be teaching the subject. And let's suppose that that's true, and there's good reasons to believe that it's true. When you're working in an open environment, you don't need to package all of these things under the same roof and in the same building. Because the researchers, if they're doing open research, and there's a whole domain called open research, right? A whole discipline called open research. And so if they're researching openly, they will be interacting with students on a regular basis anyways, just as part of their research. That's what I do. I work for a research agency. And here I am interacting with you. And I do lots of conversations like this. And it's just part of the research for me, Right.
Okay.
But it's also part of the learning, and it's, you know, it's the research and the teaching combined, but it's doing it openly. So
okay. Yeah.
The openness response to that objection.
Okay. That's a good point. I haven't thought of it that way. Let's see here. What we have to have is some kind of openness or a huge amount of openness. But I'm just wondering. I have very, very real thoughts on this. But how about sort of the business model for education? Is that just something that is just not present, or how would it look?
This idea that education has to turn a profit is a recent one and not a well-considered one. These same industries that are demanding that education institutions turn a profit would go out of business if they did not have a steady and free supply of well-educated and well-trained employees coming through their doors. The argument is overwhelming that education is a social good, and that the commercial sector especially benefits significantly from the public subsidy of education that exists. And imagine even, just to take an extreme example, but it really makes the case. Imagine McDonald's had to pay for a person's education from kindergarten to, say, grade 10 or grade 11, what they need to work at McDonald's. Imagine McDonald's had to pay that for each and every one of its employees before they could even walk through the door and sell their first hamburger. That person's education, that person who's selling you fries at McDonald's, that person's education cost already about $100,000. That's more than McDonald's is going to pay them probably ever. So the capacity of a person to take French fry orders, make the French fries, and give proper change, that capacity has been completely subsidized by the state. And it then becomes ridiculous for a person at McDonald's to turn around and say, oh, well, that education should somehow be made to pay for itself. My answer is, if you want education to pay for itself, then make every employer pay for the education of every employee. And, of course, nobody's ever going to accept that. But then neither should they accept the equally absurd proposition that some person ought to pay $100,000 out of their own pocket in order to be qualified to serve French fries at McDonald's. Or another $100,000 in order to be qualified to save sick and dying people. What is the business model of education? You're going to start arguing business models of education, then I want to use real economics and not the fake economics that have been so prevalent recently.
That's a good point. I'm not sure how. I'm from Denmark. I live in Copenhagen, and I guess we get money to study in Denmark. I don't know if you heard of that. We get like to go to university.
Yeah, I knew about that.
So that, you see that as something getting spread out. We, of course, we pay over our tax and stuff like that. But is that a model that you could recognize?
It's a model I would support. It's not a model that is gaining traction elsewhere, though, which is funny because, you look at Denmark, you know, and it's a modern, advanced, very open, very socially progressive country that is clearly reaping the benefits of this model of education. You know, I look at a country like Denmark, and I look at where I live. Similar sort of climate, similar sort of geography. We're both maritime. Denmark's maybe got more farmland than New Brunswick does, but not a whole lot. We got more trees anyway. So, and we struggle much more than Denmark struggles with things like literacy and being able to, you know, and being able to have the staff, the human resources on the ground to attract business and industry or develop any of our own. You know, simply because we haven't made these educational opportunities available to everybody in society. You know, so, you know, to me, the logic of it is overwhelming, but, you know, the desire of companies not to pay for education that they benefit from is also overwhelming.
Yeah, yeah, it's true. But it's funny because I work at the Copenhagen Business School, and right now, I mean, we are also in Denmark feeling the financial crisis, and the government is
sure, it's
of course cutting funds for education and stuff like that as well.
Yep.
So now we are also looking into how to both provide new courses on Coursera, I think, and also sort of taking benefits of these courses. So, I mean, we are also moving in a direction. And I guess, but what sort of CBS is focusing on is maybe trying to increase the quality of education by maybe instead of reducing, well, basically just by putting a lot of learning online, but then having a lot of the interactions that normally go to lectures, having that with the teacher in class, basically.
Yeah.
I think that is something that's a great innovation in the learning experience,
I guess. Sure.
Where MOOCs is also a potential huge benefit.
Yeah, and to the extent that MOOCs make the provision of public access to education more effective and more efficient and more economical, I think those in and of themselves are convincing business arguments or business models for MOOCs. I think there's no question. I mean, countries like India are very interested in this model, and they're interested in this model because they have an overwhelming need for public education, which they easily recognize. And MOOCs give them a way of approaching some way of doing that, whereas before it was just simply, you know, doing it traditionally. It's just not feasible. It was the cost. There isn't enough money in the world to provide a traditional education for everybody to benefit from one in India. There's just not enough money. Well, except stored in offshore bank accounts, but you know what I mean. The money doesn't exist. So.
Yeah, there's not enough educators there's not enough people.
You face a huge logistics problem because, it takes, 10 years to properly educate a teacher. So, but you need teachers to do that. So, eventually you can get up to a critical mass of teachers, but it takes 100 years to do it just because each iteration takes another 10 years. So, you need more effective, much more broadly based open learning in order to support the sort of infrastructure you're going to need to provide education for a country like India or China or South America. I mean, all of these regions are acutely aware of the need and are very interested in these technologies.
Yeah. Well, one thing I completely agree. One thing I've sort of heard that the access to internet, which is what you need access to internet on a computer base, or a smartphone, whatever, is something that we sometimes take for granted in the discussion about MOOCs. Like we call it the democratization of education, but if you don't even have access to the internet, you're still lost and you're just getting farther behind. So, I mean, that's an area where that lacks some kind of leadership and it's sort of missing in the discussion.
Yeah, it's, well, I mean, there's two sides to this, right? Because you can argue, okay, well, now it's making the poor people even poorer because they need that much more in order to catch up, right? They need internet access to internet computers and all of that. But look at what they would have needed otherwise, right? They would have needed, you know, like China would need 10,000 university campuses, an equivalent number of professors, huge, massive libraries of books, right? You would need to buy books for every, you know, college and university student in China. And, you know, I mean, and I've seen firsthand evidence of the challenge of that. I've known people in China, you know, and they've come over and they brought their personal libraries with them, and they're, you know, on their, bootleg copies of textbooks on rice paper, that were produced as cheaply as possible because that was the only way to make it possible to distribute these resources. I mean, providing the infrastructure needed for an education in a pre-internet world is an incredibly expensive enterprise. So, yes, there is an expense to building computer networks and providing people with computers, but overall it's cheaper. It's a lot cheaper. It's like orders of magnitude cheaper. That's one of the reasons why we do it. You know, look at books. You know, just in the open commercial market, the books used to cost, you know, $20-$30. Now they're lucky if they get $2 or $3 for it, the electronic version. Well, yeah, okay, a person had to pay for the internet and pay for the reader to access that book. But on that one book alone, they've just saved $28. You know, if they read 10 books a month, they're saving $280 a month on books, which is probably more than they can ever have afforded to spend in the past. So they're ahead of the game. And all they've done is read 10 books. And they're probably also watching TV, listening to music, chatting with their friends, using it to make art and essays and whatever. So, you know, no, I mean, the argument that the need for technology pushes the poor people further behind does not hold water. It's more expensive to do it the old way.
Yeah, yeah. But I would just, it was different, I think, about sort of how many people are actually lacking access to it.
Yeah. Oh yeah.
I mean, that struck me the other day that the sort of in my head when I read about MOOCs and I read about open education, I'm already sort of seeing it as something that is kind of changed the world and that maybe is changing the world right now. But I'm like, well, before that can even happen, you need to, all the people who really need this education to be able to get it. The infrastructure is still not there yet.
Yep, I totally agree with that. I mean, but I'm shocked by the number of people who cannot get food and clean water, who do not have bathrooms or you know, in their house. I'm shocked by the people who cannot get basic health care, who suffer diseases that we have $5 vaccinations for. It's not just education, and I want to be clear too. education by itself isn't going to change that. You know, and a lot of people use education as a proxy, and they talk about, you know, the things they'll do in education, or they criticize existing models of education simply so they don't have to address fundamental inequalities through economic means, such as paying their taxes. So, you know, there is, I think, ample evidence that there's enough wealth on the planet to support the people of the planet, even though there's an awful lot of people on the planet. And that evidence is that the top 1% has 40% of the wealth on the planet. They have more money than can be spent on stuff.
Yeah.
So, you know.
Yeah.
Yeah. So there's clearly a distribution that happens here, a distribution problem that happens here.
Okay. So I have this final question here. What are the moving into this sort of a new paradigm of and education? What are the initial actions that we have to take, and who will or what will provide the leadership?
Well, you will.
yeah.
So and you know, I think the key initial action that people have to take is to work and learn openly. And by so doing, each person becomes in their own way a model and an example for other people to follow. And except for, you know, the very youngest of infants, everybody on the planet has somebody younger than them who can follow them and look up to them. And in fact, that's exactly what happens, right? And we who are older should do our work and live our lives in as open a way as possible so that other people can see, without pressure or anything like that, but can see and learn from our examples and have models that they can follow.
And
good models, as opposed to the models they sometimes get now through mass media. I still remember walking around Bogota with Diego Liao, and we're talking about this and talking about the importance of role models, and we saw a father repairing his car on the road, and as he was repairing his car, explaining everything he did to his son, who was watching. And, you know, you think of the different ways the father could have handled the situation of his car breaking down at the side of the road. And in Colombia, you know, they had, you know, difficulties. I forget what the guy's name is, but the big drug lord who was the role model for so many people and people in Colombia looking to, was it Menendez? I forget who it was. Looking at him as a role model. And the father, with that one action, is replacing a drug lord as a role model with himself, somebody who is capable of repairing and making a car work again, which is much more immediate and much more powerful and much more empowering. And that's the sort of action that's needed.
That goes across institutions and individuals, I guess.
Yeah.
The openness to that.
It cuts across everything.
Yeah.
You know, and, you know, people complain about the bad influence of television. They complain about the bad influence of video games. And my answer to them is, well, what are you offering as an alternative? What are you putting out there instead? People complain about, well, we don't have enough engineers in society. I said, well, how many free engineering courses did you offer last year? Oh, none. You know? Well, why are you complaining then? So, you know, what people want, they should make available. you know, what people want to see they should be. We have politicians complaining about how our young people don't follow proper standards anymore, and at the same time they're crooked and their hands are grabbing money from the public purse. You know, I mean, that's the role model that they're providing. And the more open our politics is, the less likely that sort of behavior can prevail. So, same with the banking system. The whole mortgage crisis, if we had an open banking system where people could see the flow of money, then the people who were buying the poison pill assets that were composed of bad mortgages would know up front that they're composed of bad mortgages. And we avoid our economic collapse because we don't have billions of dollars invested in what turns out to be worthless mortgages.
So we see this moving towards openness in education. At least trends are sort of happening.
That's a big trend. Yeah.
Yeah. What are the immediate challenges that are coming that we need to overcome in order to meet them? What do you see sort of in the
The immediate and obvious challenge here is the balancing of openness and privacy. And we're seeing that played out in things like Facebook, where people are posting naked pictures of themselves online and then are being surprised when these are being shared all around the world. And so there's this balance that has to take place in everybody's life, what they put online and what they don't. I mean, openness is a virtue, and it is something that we should practice, and it should be a default. But that doesn't mean you put naked pictures of yourself on the internet. And you need to see that balance there. And it also doesn't mean that other people have the right to access naked pictures of you or to spy on you. I think... Like right now, it's so difficult because everything is so private that things that should be legitimately open are as difficult to share as things that are legitimately private. The whole WikiLeaks thing, for example, is sharing data that should legitimately be open. But they have to use, you know, underhanded and possibly illegal methods because this data is so locked up. And I think that in a different environment, it would be easier for us to distinguish between the open and the private, and easier for us to protect the private, because we wouldn't be protecting so much that should be open by accident. But no matter how you express this, it's a challenge. It's a big challenge. And so I think, you know, concordant with a philosophy of openness, we have to have a philosophy of ownership over one's own data, one's own records. That's a technological challenge, and it's also a legal challenge.
True. To overcome. I mean, it's a big battle, basically. Okay, so that was actually my final question. One thing I just wanted to ask you, because I know you teach the version of MOOCs, which is the connectedness approach. And then there's the Coursera and edX approach, which is more of a traditional learning pattern. But what I'm sometimes when I'm interviewing students, what I'm getting out is that the connectivist element of studying is still happening in those, even though the technology is not always provided. I mean, at least to a degree happening in the phones.
Yeah, I've seen that too. Yeah.
I think that's quite amazing. I mean, I was surprised by that, actually. That something, well, with it controls itself in some sense. So, when in the only place where people are really allowed to express themselves, mm-hmm. it still happens. So that's a great thing.
Yeah, it's only when they start limiting access to these, you know, edX-style MOOCs that you'll run into issues. As long as the access to these things is open and the other technology exists, these communities can form. And,
yeah.
you know, it's sort of a way of converting traditional MOOCs into connectivist MOOCs.
Yeah, exactly. It's quite nice to see, and I think that also when I talk to teachers, it's also what you mentioned, that a lot of the teachers who ask to teach a MOOC on Coursera or whatever, they're ready for it, so engaging in the forum, but also acknowledges that they can't answer all questions, but begin to see that there are students who are answering questions which in ways that they could never answer a question.
Yeah, exactly.
In ways that they could never provide us such an answer, and that, and they are learning so much for themselves in these courses, which is quite amazing, which comes as a complete surprise to many of these teachers. I think that's such a, that's just amazing experience, I guess, completely. Well, Stephen, thank you very much for your time.
Oh, you're very welcome.
It's been good to get your thoughts. And I'm using a lot of your writings in my thesis. So thank you for that as well.
Oh, no problem. That's what it's there for.
Yeah. Okay. Have a great day.
Thanks. You too.
Okay. Bye.
Bye-bye. And that was my interview with Thomas Rousing, who, as we heard, is from Denmark and working on his PhD. So, good. And today is March 28, 2013. I'm in my office in Moncton. It's a partly cloudy day outside with a light wind and about 5 degrees. Bye, everyone.